Exodus chapter 18. We come to the place now where Israel, having gone through the initial testing of whether they were going to obey the Lord or not, are brought now into the mountains of Horeb, which is the general mountain range, and then Mount Sinai, which is believed to be the one particular mountain in the range of Horeb. There are a number of plains in this area in which could accommodate the 2.5 to 3 million people that would have accompanied Moses in this trip. But as they're about to hear from the Lord and get direction in regard to their life specifically, namely when the Lord gives to Moses the Ten Commandments and then the various precepts, and then eventually through the end of this chapter or the end of this book, you're going to see specific instructions in regard to the erection of the tabernacle. So you've got this whole thing. The rest of Exodus basically is getting the law of Moses, and then the specific. Most people think when Moses went up on Mount Sinai, he brought back the two tablets of stone with all the Ten Commandments on them, and basically that was it. But actually, he came back with a set of engineering specifications on how to build this tabernacle, and those were the two aspects that he got. And the rest of this book has to deal with the law and with the tabernacle. Now, obviously, we've already seen the logistical problem of dealing with so many people. And we come to chapter 18. It says, Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law. If you remember when he first fled from Pharaoh, he came into the land of Midian. And in that place, he started helping some shepherdess girls that were taking care of their flocks, and in so doing he endeared himself to this family and eventually came in and to help them, and then he received his wife. And he is now, Jethro has come out, he's heard all that God has done for Moses and for Israel, his people, that the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back with her two sons, of whom the name of one was Gershom, for he said, I have been a stranger in a foreign land. When he went back into Egypt to bring the people out, he entrusted his wife and his children with his father-in-law. And the name of the other one was Eliezer, for he said, the God of my father was my help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. So he named his two sons after his experiences. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness, where he encamped at the mountain of God. Now this mountain, again, is the overall range there in the Sinai, which would have been Mount Horeb. They're not right at Sinai yet. But he had said to Moses, I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and your two sons with her. And Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, bowed down and kissed him, and when they asked each other about their well-being, they went into the tent. And Moses told his father-in-law all the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardship that had come upon them on the way, and how the Lord had delivered them. And this must have really blown Jethro's mind. You know, he's heard this story. But, you know, you see your son-in-law go off to Egypt, and he's going to do something there along the nature of deliver the people of Israel out of Egypt. And you're thinking, yes, right, we'll see. And just to hear the entire Egyptian army being vanquished in the Red Sea, to hear of the plagues, to hear of these things being recounted, I can just imagine Jethro's amazement. And now he is called the priest of Midian, and obviously as a priest he is mediating between the people and a god. And there's a different, we really don't know where Jethro's coming from. We don't know whether his mindset is to truly worship Jehovah. This conclusion in his mind, in verse 10, it says, Jethro said, Blessed be the Lord who has delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, and has delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods, for in the very thing in which they behaved proudly, he was above them. Or the very thing they trusted. The very aspect, you see, there, the very many gods that they worshipped and they relied upon, God basically used them in the plagues. And so Jethro saw this as kind of poetic justice. The very thing they were trusting in, God used to vanquish them. Now Jethro says this, now I know he's the Lord. So what was it that Jethro was representing at that point? We don't know. Whether he has come to a knowledge of Jehovah at this point, enough to follow him, we don't know. because it says on the next day, and you know, he gives Moses some advice in regard to the number of people, but then eventually parts company with Moses and goes his own way. So we really don't know whether he is going to be one who is going to throw his lot in with the people of God or not. Now it says that Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices to God, and Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. So they're making a sacrifice. Jethro is playing that role here. But it was in the next day that Moses sat to judge the people, and the people stood before Moses from morning until evening. And when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did for the people, he said, what is this thing you're doing for the people? Why do you sit and all the people stand before you from morning until evening? And Moses said to his father-in-law, because the people come to me to inquire of God. And when they have a difficulty, they come to me, and I judge between one and another, and I make known the statutes of God and his laws. So Moses' father-in-law said to him, the thing that you do is not good. Both you and this people who are with you will surely wear yourselves out, for this thing is too much for you. You are not able to perform it by yourself. That's a small understatement, I would imagine. I can imagine just the problems that would arise as a result of having 2.5 million people. I mean, we can get a room full of 100 people and still have strife sometimes, you know? Differences of opinions and, well, he did this, no he didn't, he pushed me, no he didn't, you know? Can you imagine 2.5 million people, all their kids and their flocks and hey, I was on this spot of the desert right here. You know, this is my tree. Get away from here. And the problems that would have resulted. And Moses is there trying to pronounce fairness and equity in the word of the Lord to them and dealing with them. And really, it takes all day. Basically, his whole day is spent in judging the situations of the people. So Jethro is a man who is an interesting character. We don't know where he's coming from, and yet he presumes to give Moses advice. And for some reason, the Lord is really acknowledging it because he doesn't tell Moses any differently. And Moses follows along suit with it. And actually, God honors it with the advice that he gives. What is his advice? He says, listen out of my voice. I'll give you counsel and God will be with you. Stand before God for the people so that you may bring the difficulties to God. In other words, that's your role, Moses. Yes, you are to bring the difficulties to God. You're to stand before them. You're to be mediating. And he says, and you shall teach them the statutes and the laws and show them in the way that they should walk and the work they must do. Moreover, you shall select from all the people able men such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, rulers of tens, and let them judge the people at all times. Then it will be that every great matter they shall bring to you, but every small matter they themselves shall judge. So it will be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you. And if you do this thing and God so commands, then you'll be able to endure, and all this people will go to their place in peace. So in reality, it is some sound counsel. Basically, all the smaller issues would be dealt with by the judge who was judging 10 people. It's kind of like a little home group leader. He's going to make the decision on something that comes up in the home group. But if it's too difficult for him, he'll go to the judge of 100. And he's kind of in a group himself, so to speak. You know, the group that are looking over tens, he's now in a group of 10 people that are overlooking the other tens. And then if that situation is too difficult for that leader, it'll go to the next. And eventually something that's too difficult for everyone will get to Moses, but he will only be dealing with the difficult cases. Now, I kind of like this. I think the structure of this is quite wise. It allows people to lead with the ability God has given them. In other words, they have the capacity to deal with some of the smaller issues, so why burden Moses with it? Let them deal with it. And the things that come on right on down, as they're instructed, they'll learn as they go, and so they can become wiser leaders as time goes on. They're entrusted with a little, they're faithful to a little, God can entrust to them more. But I do appreciate the fact that this is still a logistical amazement to me, because of all the judges, if you figure 2.5 million people, I calculate that there was a need for about 78,000 judges. Now that's still an incredible lot of people to just teach. We can fill a giant stadium up, and can you imagine, just those are just the leaders, a giant stadium, and then they're going out and dispersing all the different instructions to the various people. So it's an amazing thing. But notice the type of people that are entrusted with this. Notice the qualities, and I think there is real wisdom here, and I think that especially in leadership, especially today, there is a need for people of integrity. And I love these qualities. These are very important qualities. These are qualities that I look for in men whom I see the Lord raising up to be pastors and leaders and home group fellowship leaders. He says, people who are able men. Now, you have to have an ability. It's certainly God-given if you do have an ability, so you can't boast in it, to say, hey, I've got this ability, I've got this talent. If you do have it, God gave it to you. But certainly you need it in order to lead. You'd have to have, if you were going to be a judge of something, you'd have to have the ability to wisely discern what's going down. Not be moved by someone's tears, perhaps, in a situation, or not be swayed with a bribe or be impartial. You'd need to have the ability to do the right thing. And the second quality is such as fear God. Now, I think you can pretty much, all the other qualities would be really in comparison to this one fact. All the other qualities are nothing in comparison to this, because from this one quality comes everything else. In fact, my basic, my feeling is that if a person fears God, if they reverence God, I don't have to watch them that closely in one sense. I don't have to worry about where they're at if I'm not seeing them. There are types of people who serve to be men pleasers. They do things as looks good, as what appears good in front of men. You know, the kind of people that, you know, in fact, they've even got computer games. And this is the funny thing. I've got a few of these computer games. And on your computer, there's a thing called, you know, quick, the boss is coming. And you push a button and up, you know, pops the screen that looks like you're actually doing work. You know, so you're playing this game and the boss is coming. Bang, you know, you push this button and the screen pops up. And it looks like now you're doing this spreadsheet, you know. And it cracks me up because really that is the mentality for many people. They do what they have to do, what is an appearance sake, what people will be noticing. And if no one notices, well, hey, no one sees what they don't see, I'm going to get away with. Naturally, a quality such as this would be important if you weren't able to see everything. If you're a leader, you want people that you can trust. You know, there is so much crime today. People are trying to get away with all kinds of things. And, you know, shoplifting is an incredible problem. It numbers into the billions of dollars that people lose because of dishonest workers or shoplifters. Whatever they can do to get away with it without being seen. But if you have a person who fears God, you see, he is not worried about whether anybody's watching him or not. His conscience is before the Lord. He is going to do the right thing no matter what. That's the type of person you want in leadership. You don't want to have to keep watching them. I know in developing, you know, as you know, a pastor in various ministries that other people have been developed in, it really sometimes takes time to develop this too. You have to learn lessons. You know, there are times when you can fall into that trap of doing things before men rather than before God. And the Lord has to catch you and remind you, whom are you serving? The Bible says, do your work heartily as unto the Lord rather than unto men. So this quality, fearing God, is very important. Thirdly, men of truth. Obviously, men who are going to be equipped with truth. They're going to be truthful in all their dealings. They're going to be honest. They're going to be people that are going to be speaking the truth in love, men of truth, not speaking one thing and meaning another and speaking out of the side of their mouth, speaking behind your back. Men of truth, they're going to say what they mean and they're going to mean what they say. And I'll tell you, that is a rare quality today too. You know, in fact, it seems that the higher person goes in leadership, the less people, you know, under him really are, there's more intimidation. It's a sad thing. When this church was 25 people, you know, people were not intimidated by me at all. They told me exactly what they felt. And I painfully had to live with all of it, you know. But that was good in a way, but because there is a sense now as the church has grown and people have this awe of what God is doing here, as if it's some attributable, you know, purpose to me, you know, as if I have done it. It's God's work. And so they get around me and they kind of look at me and put me up on a pedestal and think of me as, you know, ooh, holy man of God, you know. And so they watch their P's and their Q's around me, and they never quite tell me what they really think, because they're calculating, what is he going to think about me? And, you know, you get into that and it's just a bunch of nonsense. Better just to be who you are and be honest with what you say, what you mean, and mean what you say. But I have to admit that it's not an easy quality to arrive at. Because I myself, when I get around Chuck Smith, I want to be just, hey, let's hang out with Chuck, you know. But I'm like, you know, I better just shut up and listen, because I don't want to say anything stupid around him. And so I'm like, I'm intimidated. It happens. But men of truth, very important quality. Then there's this aspect of hating covetousness. Hating dishonest gain. Or even hating the fact that you covet after things. Personally, I think that we need to chide ourselves when we find ourselves coveting. And it's one of the commandments that later we'll see here in Exodus chapter 20. It's in fact the 10th commandment. It's dealing with the inner heart of man. You see, no one can really know whether you're coveting something. No one can see your heart. No one can tell what your desires are. But if you know for yourself, when you pass by those beautiful homes down there and some of the parts in New Jersey, you come by some beautiful homes and you covet, or you want this or you want that. And the tendency is there's pressure then to get something more, to get something more. The eyes of man, Solomon said, are never satisfied. But if we recognize this about our nature, we can chide it. We can continue to tell ourselves, hey, be content with what you have. I'd much rather be content with what I have than be forced in a situation where I do something dishonest in order to get ahead, to do something that's not quite right. So here, these men who are leaders, who are called men of truth, men, able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, rulers of tens, and they'll judge every matter, and if it's too difficult, then they'll bring it to you. So Moses heeded, verse 24, the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he had said. And Moses chose able men out of Israel and made them heads over the people, rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, rulers of tens. So they judged the people at all times. And the hard cases they brought to Moses, but they judged every small case themselves. And Moses let his father-in-law depart, and he went his way to his own land. So Jethro doesn't hang around. That's last we, there's a few other incidences that I believe he pops up, but that's pretty much the main segment in regard to him. Now in the third month after the children of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on the same day they came to the wilderness of Sinai. Now they're in that general region where Sinai, the granite rock face would just rise up before them, and the plain there of Sinai, the wilderness of Sinai, where they could all dwell together. In fact, I'm told I've never been there. One of these days, if the situation gets a little better between Egypt and Israel, I'd like to have an extension to on our Israel trip to go down into the Sinai region, maybe see the go into Egypt, see the various pyramids, kind of follow the route, you know, as best we can figure out from where they would have went down into the Sinai region, and just see kind of some of that wilderness. But I'm told that there's kind of a natural plain that rises up into where the mountain is, and it would be like almost like a natural amphitheater. You could basically speak to large groups of people in that area, and because of the natural rock faces and the way it's formed, basically you could get in the hearing, people could hear you. Even in the Sea of Galilee region, we found that you can go down to the bottom of a ravine, and if people are seated on the hill, you know, they can, the voice carries, and you can speak to thousands of people without sound equipment. It's really a fascinating thing. 2.5 million people would be quite a challenge, and I imagine keeping all those babies quiet was the ushers were busy, I'm sure. Well, they departed from Rephidim and came to the desert of Sinai and camped into the wilderness. So Israel camped there before the mountain. And Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the children of Israel. Now he's giving them very clear instructions now. You have seen what I have done, what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. There's a beautiful picture in here of how God deals with his people. When a young little eaglet needs to begin flying, he's growing up, he's starting to learn how to fly, the mother will do something very interesting. You know, out there up on that rock cliff, you know, which just is a sheer drop, the mother eagle will push those little eaglets as they're beginning to develop their wings out of the nest. And they'll kind of flutter. They can't fly, but they're fluttering and they're going fast down. And at the last moment, the eagle would come down and bear up the little ones. And basically, by this pattern over and over again, the young eagles develop their strength and their wings to support themselves. Now, the Lord is basically saying, this is how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. You know, pushed out of Egypt now, and yet the Lord has borne them up on his wings. They're learning how to walk. They're learning how to follow him. They're learning lessons that are essential in being obedient to the Lord. And that relationship is like that, being born on eagle's wings. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for the earth is mine. So there is a covenant he is going to make with them. If you keep it, you'll be a special treasure. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel. Now the idea of them being a kingdom of priests and a holy nation is that they were set apart as a nation. They were chosen by God to be his own special treasure, his own special people. But in one sense, they were all acting as priests to the world. That was the role that God had intended for the nation Israel. They were the nation, though they had priests and the priestly tribe of Levi eventually that the Lord set into the nation Israel, they themselves as a nation were considered to be priests because they were representing to the people of the world who knew not God. They were representing what God was all about. They were to be a light. They were to be a witness in a way. They were to be shining the nature of God so that people who followed other gods would be able to see what the true and living God was all about. And that was their role. So Moses came and called for the elders of the people and laid before them all these words which the Lord commanded him. And all the people answered together and said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." Boy, that sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Hey, everything he says, we'll do, no problem. It's all ours. And Moses brought back the words of the people to the Lord. So he is, you know, in the mediation here. He is hearing from the Lord. He's speaking to the people. He's hearing what their response is now in this covenant. He's going back to the Lord and he's representing them before the Lord. And they're basically consenting even before they hear any of the conditions of this covenant. This is an interesting thing. They're consenting to follow him, the Lord, even before they hear the conditions of this covenant. And the conditions are given in Leviticus, the entire book of the law there, all the different aspects of the laws in Leviticus, and some here in Exodus. But before they even hear what they're called to do, they're saying, "Hey, we'll do it. We'll follow him. We're ready." So the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I come to you in the thick cloud that the people may hear when I speak with you and believe you forever." So Moses told the words of the people to the Lord. Now, the Lord is saying, "I'm going to come and I'm going to speak in a way that they can all hear me audibly so that they'll know that this just is not you, Moses, but it's me." And the Lord said to Moses, "Go unto the people and sanctify them today and tomorrow and let them wash their clothes. Let them be ready for the third day. For on the third day the Lord will come down upon Mount Sinai in the sight of the people. You shall set bounds for the people all around, saying, 'Take heed to yourselves that you do not go up to the mountain or touch its base. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. Not a hand shall touch him, but he shall surely be stoned or shot with an arrow, whether man or beast, he shall not live. And when the trumpet sounds long, they shall come near the mountain.'" So apparently there is this arbitrary boundary that he is setting around the mountain, basically as a testing ground for the people. Hey, don't pass this line. Now, if you're like me, and human nature is the same all the way around, you know, you'll walk right up to that little barrier. You'll go, I wonder what the difference is on this side or that side. I mean, I really, this is kind of an interesting. I mean, why did he set the barrier right here? I mean, if I take one step in, I'll be stoned. And I imagine you look around, you know, think, come on. What's the difference? Who's going to know? And that's how human nature is. Look at Eve in the garden. God told Adam and Eve, "Of every tree you may freely eat, this one tree don't eat." Where do you think Eve was hanging around, you know, of all places in the garden? By that one tree. You know, that's human nature. Really? I'm not supposed to do this? Why? You know, this is really the effect of the law. And basically, as the Lord gets detailed on what law he's expecting of his people, this is really the first test. Don't come near this mountain. Don't pass this boundary. And the idea there is that what it does, the law produces in me a desire to know why that particular law. A lot of times people want to know, well, why did God say this? And they want to test it. How, you know, maybe it's just arbitrary. How do I know I'm going to really, it's going to bother me, it's going to hurt somebody? If I do this, it's not hurting anybody. But the law is doing it as a test for us. But our nature is, you know, we want to test it. I have a friend, well, Gail Irwin said this story that was quite interesting. He was, he said his friend had come up to him and said, you know, I learned a very important lesson about the law. Our 2-year-old daughter, we were going out that night and we left the 2-year-old daughter in the hands of the babysitter. And we said to her, now, whatever you do, don't push any beans up your nose. You know, just saying it in fun and jest, you know, just a silly thing to say. And he says, I don't know why I said it, but I just said it. And I didn't even think about it. And I came back and the babysitter had to take her to emergency and get the beans out of her nose that had got jammed up there. And, you know, that's human nature. Here's this 2-year-old kid thinking, why? I wonder what will happen if I put beans up my nose. And so the poor little kid's got beans stuck up his nose. He's got to get them out by emergency doctors. But it just illustrates that's human nature. The thing we can't do. What did Paul say? He said, when the law says thou shalt not covet, what did it do? It produced in me coveting of all kinds. Not that the law is bad, but what the law is doing is it's revealing what my heart is like. And that's what's going on here. So Moses went down from the mountain to the people and sanctified the people, and they washed their clothes and said to the people, be ready in the third day. Do not come near your wives. So in other words, there's this time of separation. This is a very serious and solemn moment. They're commanded to abstain from normal sexual relationships with their husbands and wives for a period of time, to be fasting, waiting, washing their clothes. This is a very special meeting that they're having. And it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there were thunderings and lightnings and thick clouds on the mountain, and the sound of the trumpet was very loud, so that all the people were in the camp trembled. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain, and Mount Sinai was completely in smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked greatly. And when the blast of the trumpet sounded long and became louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him by voice. This is saying that God answered him, and the people heard, and they heard audibly the voice of God. And the Lord came down upon Mount Sinai on the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. And the Lord said to Moses, go down and warn the people, lest they break through to gaze at the Lord, and many of them perish. Also let the priests who come near the Lord sanctify themselves, lest the Lord break out against them. Now the priesthood had not been established at this time, so it's believed that the priests who he's referring to would have been those whom the Lord owned. Who were the Lord's? All the firstborn. Later, when Levi is chosen, God says Levi will be in place of the firstborn. In other words, the tribe of Levi will be mine, they'll be priests unto me. So I believe at this point he's referring to those who are firstborn. Let those come near the Lord, sanctify themselves, lest the Lord break out against them. And Moses said to the Lord, the people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for you warned us, saying, set bounds around the mountain and sanctify. And the Lord said to him, away, get down and then come up, you and Aaron with you, but do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break out against them. And Moses went down to the people and spoke to them. Now if you compare this to Hebrews chapter 12, you'll see a little bit of an insight into this subject. You see, we have this new covenant with Jesus. And the first covenant, however, came with a very strong sense of you don't refuse him who speaks. And if they didn't escape who refused him who spoke to them on earth, how much more should we be conscious of refusing, you know, God? We should not refuse God who speaks to us from heaven. Verse 26 of Hebrews 12, he says, for his voice shook the earth then, but now he is promised, saying, yet once more I shake not only the earth, but also heaven. Now this yet once more indicates the removal of those things that are being shaken, as that cannot be shaken, those that cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us have grace by which we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear, for our God is a consuming fire. In other words, there's a real sense that we need to have as believers that our God is awesome. But the covenant that we have, he compared in verse 18 of chapter 12 of Hebrews. He describes this. You haven't come to a mountain that may be touched and may be burned with fire, to blackness and darkness and tempest. And he describes this event. Verse 19, the sound of a trumpet, the voice of words, so that those who heard it begged that the word should not be spoken to them anymore. In other words, they said, hey, we can't hear anymore. We're afraid. So much so that they told Moses, you know, you go up and speak to him. We don't want to hear this anymore. We can't handle this. And so it was a terrifying sight. But verse 22 says, but you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly of church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven, to God, the judge of all, the spirits of all just men made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant and the blood of sprinkling that speaks of better things than of Abel. So therefore, see that you do not refuse him. So they had this experience. They came to this mountain and they were terrified as a result. And God spoke all these words, saying, now all these words are an idiom for the Ten Commandments, later given that title in Deuteronomy 4:13 and Exodus 34:28, given the title of the Decalogue, or the Ten Words. He says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. So law number one, you shall have no other gods before me. Now, the Ten Commandments are generally divided between 4 and 6. There's 4 commandments in regard to our relationship with God, and then there's 6 commandments in regard to our relationship with people, our social requirements. It's interesting that the Lord puts the ones to him first, and I think that if you can be conscious of the first 4, if you can be aware of our requirement to God, and you have that relationship with the Lord in the right place, as believers coming to Jesus Christ and submitting unto him, then your relationship with others will be in a much better position to be right. First, you have to have your relationship with the Lord right before your relationship with others can be right. It's kind of like a vertical, horizontal type of a setup. If your vertical is right, your horizontal will be right. If your vertical is tilted, your relationship with people will also be off kilter. So there's a good lesson here. Now, the Roman Catholic Church and the Lutherans do a little bit different with the numbering here. They basically take the first 2 commandments and combine them as 1. And then they, in order to come up with 10, on the last commandment, they kind of divide that into 2. Thou shalt not covet your neighbor's house, and you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. They take those 2 things as 2 separate commands so that they get 10. They divide it a little bit differently. One of the reasons I think that division is not that accurate is because when you look at Deuteronomy 5, chapter 6 through 11, which is another record of these laws repeated, the order of the last commandment is switched. It's switched to not covet your neighbor's wife first and then your neighbor's house. So naturally, they have a problem then, which is the 9th or which is the 10th, depending on which version you read. So I think that division is not a natural division. I think the natural division comes between what we see as the first 4 commandments. And the first one is to have no other gods before me. And the second one is you shall not make for yourself any carved image. That's the second commandment. Now they're similar, but there is a distinction. One is to not put anything before me. The other is to not make any representation, any idol or anything that even would try to represent the things of God. The first commandment is a very important commandment, and I believe it's out of God's mercy that he tells us this. God is a jealous God. He wants our attention. He wants our worship. He is God. He's worthy of our worship. And really, this is good for us. If we put something before the Lord, it really hurts us. We're the ones that get shortchanged. Then we have no capacity and resource in which to live our lives the way that God would intend to live them, the way that would protect us in the right place. If we don't put him first, if we have other gods before him, if God is not the first priority of our life, then we're only setting ourselves up for disappointment. We're only going to be frustrated. We're only going to be struggling within our life. It's important that we understand that. You shall have no other gods before me. Secondly, you shall not make for yourself any carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or in the earth beneath or that is in the water or under the earth, and you shall not bow down to them nor serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers and the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. Now, what is he saying here? Well, we have a tendency to naturally worship the things that we make. The irony of it is Jeremiah kind of mocks out these guys who went to the woods and chopped down a tree and fashioned this idol out of it. With part of the wood, they make this god that they worship. With part of the wood, they use in their fire to cook their food. And it's just kind of an arbitrary which part of the wood you use. One is your god and one is you're cooking your meal with. And he's making a mockery of this, and he says now that when the guy makes the idol, he sets it up so that it won't totter. You know, I mean, it would be kind of embarrassing to have a god that kind of tottered back and forth. So at least they've got to have a base for it. He says, but they have ears they can't hear, they have eyes they can't see. And yet this tendency of man to worship the makings of his own hands. Now we're a little more sophisticated perhaps than to worship these little icons, you know. And when you go over into Israel, they dig up all these little Babylonian gods, you know. Some of them are quite gross and some of them are pornographic. But they had a tendency to hold on to these things, and they felt they represented, you know, the gods of the other nations. So they'd make these things and they represented other gods. And the Lord says, hey, I'm a jealous God. No other gods before me, and don't make for yourself any images to follow. And when he says visiting the iniquity of the fathers and the third and fourth generation to the children, this is a very important principle. Sin sticks around. This doesn't mean God is punishing the children for their father's sin. What it means is that the sin of the fathers affects the children. Didn't the sin of your parents affect you and have an impact on your life in certain ways that affected you? And in effect, because of the way it affected you, it also affected your children. Certain tendencies you saw coming out that you didn't deal with, that your parents instilled in you, and now you're instilling in your children, and they're going to have the same effect. And you see what sin does is it carries through the generations. That's why it's so deadly. It's so horrible. It's something that, as a parent especially, you should think that you're not sinning for yourself. It's going to affect three generations of people. The nature of sin. But God shows mercy to thousands who love me and keep my commandments. The third commandment, he says, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. For the Lord will not hold him guiltless who take his name in vain. I believe this is a little bit more than just cussing, you know, when you're on the job, you know, if someone has a foul mouth. I have heard some Christians even tell me, well, you know, when you're in the business world, you got to be able to talk to these people the language they understand, you know. So you got to, you know, spice it up a little bit with a few of these, types of words. And I couldn't disagree more, honestly. But this isn't necessarily referring to cursing. This is something that goes a little bit more than that. You see, the name of God, and like any name, and even you'll be sensitive to that when you're reading through the Old Testament, when they gave their children names, what did it mean? It meant something about them. There was something that happened about them, and their name was given as a result. When Esau was named, he got the name because it meant hairy. And he came out all hairy, and they called him Hairy, in Hebrew Esau. And so their name meant something. Jacob came out holding his brother's heel. They called him Heel Catcher. Each of the names of the people, they had something about them. Isaac, what happened Sarah, thank you. Sarah was in labor, the whole idea was she got pregnant. She laughed. She thought that was the funniest thing. There's no way, she said, you know, in her heart, am I going to have a child? That's funny. And the angel says, hey, I heard you laughing. No, I didn't laugh. She denied it. But she gave the child the name Laughter because it was a whole new thing that happened. She just had such a kick out of having a child in her old age. We'll call the little kid Laughter. Call him Isaac. But names meant something. When God speaks about his name being holy, he's speaking about his nature, his character. And you can't take God lightly is basically the bottom line here. Don't take the nature and the character of our Lord lightly. He is holy. You can't take his nature, you can't take his teaching lightly, otherwise you will be taking his name in vain. but it also does imply that one aspect of it, which would mean to use his name lightly also. People who naturally just comes out of them, you know, GD this, and you know, you hear just in the store the other day, I was coming around a corner, and old man had this big box in his cart. It was kind of teetering. It wasn't really balanced really well. And he came around the corner when this lady was coming down this aisle with her child in a stroller. And the box fell over, not on top of the child, thank the Lord, but it fell over on the wheels of this stroller. And the lady was just livid. I mean, hey, this box came too close to my kid. And that's all she just let out this big, Jesus, you know, right on through. And obviously wasn't praising his name by the way she was using it. But, you know, I felt bad for the old man. You know, I helped him pick up his box and stuff, but, you know, put it in a way that it wouldn't totter. But it struck me. I mean, this is the world. They use the name constantly. The funny thing is, you'll never hear someone saying, oh, Buddha, you know, or oh, Muhammad, you know. There's something about the name of Jesus Christ that strikes people. And it's true, you know, certainly it's part of the nature of Satan to get us to take that name lightly. Because if we use it like that enough, then it'll harden ourselves to it. Fourth command, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, nor for you, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your manservant, nor your maidservant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. In 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the seventh Sabbath day and hallowed it. Now, there's a lot of teaching on the Sabbath that I think that, you know, we'll save for another time, only because it comes up quite frequently. And I don't want to get off tangent on this, but it is important to realize that the Sabbath day, and we will learn this, is something that God gave to the nation Israel as an eternal covenant. There are groups who feel that we should still honor the Sabbath, and technically the Sabbath is the seventh day, which is Saturday. You can't change the Sabbath to Sunday. When the Christian church in the very early part of Acts began meeting on the first day of the week, because it was the day that Jesus resurrected, so they naturally met on that day. But many of them were still Jewish, and they still kept the Sabbath. It was a part of their culture. They never changed the Sabbath. They just met on Sunday as Christians. Later it became more of a kind of a traditional thing where it was referred to as the Christian Sabbath, Sunday. But God never changed the Sabbath. It was always Saturday, and it will always be Saturday. It's the Sabbath. It's the seventh day. But then you have to ask, then what does this command have to do with us? Well, here is where, when Paul writes in Hebrews, if you feel Paul is the author of that, but I want you to turn to Hebrews chapter 4 for a moment. And we'll just touch on this. I'll probably raise more questions than anything else, but that's okay. It'll make you search the scriptures. Let's start up in verse 3. He says, "For we who have believed do enter the rest as he has said." He's speaking about this rest, meaning that Israel never entered into this rest, never entered into the promised land, never entered into the rest because of their unbelief. And he speaks about, in verse 4, he says, "For he has spoken in a certain place of the seventh day in this way, and God rested on the seventh day from all his works. And again in this place they shall not enter my rest. Since therefore it remains that some must enter it, and those to whom it was first preached did not enter it because of disobedience, he designates a certain day, saying in David, 'Today, after such a long time as it has been said, today if you'll hear my voice, do not harden your hearts.' For if Joshua had given them rest, then he would not have afterwards spoken of another day." In other words, the idea of going into the promised land was entering into their rest. But then the prophet speaks about, again, you know, receiving rest. So therefore, Joshua didn't complete that. He says, "There remains therefore a rest or a Sabbath for the people of God. For he who has entered his rest has also ceased from his works as God did from his. Therefore, let us be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall after the same example of disobedience. So in reality, the principle of the Sabbath, there's two things happening. One is it's a natural one day in seven. It's a natural biological clock that I think all of us have. When you go beyond that, when you work hard 8 days, 9 days, 10 days in a row, it has a physical effect on you. God didn't intend you to labor that long without a break. But for the covenant's sake, the seventh day was Saturday, the Sabbath, for the nation of Israel. And it will always be that. It's an eternal covenant for them. But spiritually, what it's referring to is us ceasing from our works, coming into his rest. So that in one sense, every day should be a spiritual Sabbath, a rest, ceasing from your own works, not striving. I still believe that you need to take one day in seven. Now, whether your day off comes on a Monday or a Tuesday or a Wednesday or a Friday or whatever it might be is irrelevant. Paul says in Romans that, you know, let each one regard, if one guy regards one day more important than another and another person regards another day or all days alike, let each one be firmly convinced in his own mind. But I think the principle of having one day in seven is a wise principle. However, don't misunderstand the law of the Sabbath, because this is reference as an eternal covenant to the nation Israel. We're not incumbent upon the law. Now, there are groups. There are the Seventh-day Adventists. There's Seventh-day Baptist groups. There's Armstrongism. There are various groups that believe that it was sinful for the church to get away from worshiping God and honoring him on the Sabbath and not doing any work. The problem you'll see as we get into the precepts, what does it mean to not do work on the Sabbath? That's where it gets sticky. That's where it gets quite interesting, and that's where a lot of these groups tend toward legalism. They get off on some details of all the little details of what it means not to work, to not light a fire, which means they can't start their car. Or have any hot food. And in fact, it gets pretty wild when you go to Israel. And the Sabbath day, usually the meal that you have in the hotel is just kind of warmed over. They cook it before the Sabbath, they keep it warm, and then they serve it to you. It's generally not that great a quality, but it's honoring their Sabbath, you know, because it's work for them to, you know, do any cooking, but they can have the hot plate already turned on. And they can put the food on there and keep it warm for you. And they can serve it for you. That's not work, as long as they don't cook it. And the funniest thing to me is the Sabbath elevators. I get a kick out of that. Because in the good hotels, you know, that they'll have they'll have it labeled. This is the Shabbat elevator. And on Sabbath, you can't go into a regular elevator and push a button because you've done work. You know, and by pushing a button, you've done work and you violated the Sabbath. So a Sabbath elevator, you go in it. It automatically recognizes you're there, the door will close, and it will stop on every floor. It takes a little bit longer to get up there, but you get up there. Now, if you don't want to wait that long, you can climb the stairs. And if you climb 24 flights of stairs so that you don't do work by pushing a button, then you've honored the Sabbath. It's a cultural thing. You got to be there to believe it. But I don't know if that's what the Lord had in mind. But he did have a compassion for people, because he knew the driving force and the energy of man to keep busy, to make more money and get out there and hustle. And he knew that man would probably drive himself to an early grave. So this is a very compassionate law. Now we looked at the first four, honoring the day. And really there's kind of a connection between the Sabbath day and man. It's really kind of for man. God made the Sabbath, Jesus said, for man, not man for the Sabbath. When they accused him of violating it by eating, taking some grain out of the field and rubbing it in his hands to get the husk off, that was work. That was threshing wheat. And so they counted that as work. But he says, you know, you've bound people up with the commandments and traditions of men. Now we come to the last six commandments. And the first one of the social order, I think, is very fitting. I think it's something that our nation is becoming more and more aware of, that you cannot have a good social order unless you have a strong family unit. And here it is, the first commandment in relationship to man with man in social structure: honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord God is giving you. God ordained the family unit. He did not ordain, he ordained Adam and Eve. He did not ordain Adam and Steve. He did not ordain homosexual unions. That is not God's choice. Now, there's a great amount of pressure on our legislators, the people in the office and those making the laws, because of the lobbyist groups from the homosexual, very many homosexual groups that are lobbying these people to try to get laws passed so that they will honor a homosexual marriage just like they will honor a marriage between a man and a woman. The funny part is, to me, is that God has established the order. And people who claim I'm like this, and you'll read in the newspaper about there's the new genetic evidence for why homosexuals are. It's a genetic thing. And you read this stuff, but you realize that the scientific inquiry behind it is not that accurate. One man who came out with this big thing, and it was so loudly applauded as such a great breakthrough, he said, you know, he discovered that there was a difference in this one particular gland among homosexual men and among, you know, straight men. There was a difference. So naturally it must be genetic. Well, the problem is all the different bodies that he tested, the homosexuals that he tested, all had AIDS. So who's to say that the AIDS virus didn't affect that particular gland? I mean, it's so unscientific in how they do a lot of these studies. But they want so desperately to prove that God made them this way. That it's not a choice, that they have no choice. I see scripturally that they have a choice. I see scripturally that it's a sin according to God's command, homosexual unions. But God loves homosexuals, and that does not mean that they should be treated anything less than humans. That does not mean that you would go out and stone them or treat them rudely or treat them not as people. And that's where I think we as Christians have to be wise. We need to respect and honor them as people, but we don't have to honor and laud their sin as any behavioral type of a thing that is going to have special treatment. That's where I think we have to be wise. But God has honored the family structure. He says, honor your father and your mother. This is what God has ordained. Your father and your mother should be honored. Give respect unto that family unit. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this as well. And even when you get older, there is a respect unto your mother and your father that you have, even though you have your own family unit, and that's your first priority, that's your inner circle there, you still have an honor for your father and mother. Now you need to leave and cleave when you get married. You still honor, but your main priority then is with your own family unit. God honors the family unit. First commandment, according to Ephesians, with a promise that your days will be long upon the land. When people get bent toward their father and their mother, they generally have all kinds of problems, you know, even physically, because there's a natural sense there of honoring your father and mother. I believe that the Lord has instilled in us. Then, and that is saying a lot for maybe some of you who have come out of some very, very tough homes, too. I mean, I might mention that because in our day and age, it's not uncommon, unfortunately, to hear of abuse and sexual misconduct among family units, and it's just something that's horrible to consider that. But you still would honor your father and mother in the sense of that's the role that God gave them to play, though God can and will restore you. Sixth commandment, you shall not murder. Reference to premeditated murder, not capital punishment. That was something that was taken for granted. Not even accidental murders, because that was treated quite differently. Premeditated murder was, the death penalty was prescribed in Israel, but if it was an accidental murder, it was a manslaughter, it was something that you didn't mean to do, there were certain provisions in the law for that. But there was definitely a distinct difference between murder and also when they went to war, that was not considered murder. There were 7 different words in the Hebrew for kill, and this particular one is reference to murder, which would have been a premeditated murder. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. Having sexual relationships with anyone that's not your mate is adultery. There is even a distinction, but he describes fornication and the laws against fornication later on for Israel. But there is a distinction, because oftentimes what you'll find is when a virgin was raped or something that happened, where fornication was committed, the two actually, there was a different prescription or a different thing that they had to do. For instance, if two young people got together and they slept together, they committed fornication. They had, by the nature of that, then committed themselves to marriage. And that was considered then, and it was very, very strong then. The person had to pay a penalty for that. It was quite a different thing. But with adultery, sleeping with someone else that had been married, that was a little bit stronger. And that was also, the death penalty was given to Israel for committing adultery. You shall not steal. I want to point out real quickly on that too. Jesus, in regard to murder and commit adultery, he did not limit these acts to just the outer actual doing of them, but he saw what was in the heart. And that was the whole intent of the law. You shall not steal, not taking anything that's not your own. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor, which would be lying, not lying or not producing any untruths. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, or his donkey, or anything else that isn't your neighbor's. Now, I kind of look at this last commandment as this. If you could say about the first nine commandments you've been pretty good on, and you haven't done anything against the first nine, the tenth commandment would wipe you out. Because basically what it's saying is that you don't even want to commit the first nine. Now, none of us really are that good. You know, I know for myself, if I have problems with the plumbing or if I'm problems with the home and I'm driving home and I always drive by this beautiful house on my left, you know, it's got a full court basketball court. And I think, man, it would be great to have a fellowship there. And now that house, oh, I just love that house. And the Lord catches me and he says, "You're coveting." And I said, "Lord, forget it. Thank you that I don't have to take care of that thing. I can just enjoy looking at it as I'm driving by." And I remember. But even if we could commit perfectly on the first nine, we would all get caught up on the last one, which says you shouldn't even want to commit the first nine. You wouldn't even want to. And none of us are that good. It really does reveal to us the inner law, now the inner life. Now, the whole purpose of these laws, again, God gave these laws for a number of reasons. He wanted to have some social order, obviously, among his people. He wanted to keep back or restrain sin from taking over people's lives and destroying them. He wanted men to have a fruitful life. And these laws would give him a fruitful life. If you follow these laws, if you keep these laws, it does have an effect on you for good. But what we need to know, as Christians especially, is that the purpose of the law was to show everyone is guilty before God. Romans chapter 3, verse 19, he says, "Whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped, that the whole world may be guilty before God." That's why he gave the law, to shut the whole world up, that not one person would be able to say, "I am righteous. I've done what I need to do." And then in Galatians chapter 3, 23 and 24, he says, "Before faith came, we kept under the law and shut up unto the faith which should afterwards be revealed. Wherefore faith or the law was our schoolmaster or our tutor to bring us to Christ." That's an important purpose of the law. It was a tutor. It was there to show us how far we were from God, so it would lead us to the Savior. Later, Israel, being ignorant of God's righteousness, tried to establish their own righteousness. They misused the law and the purpose of the law. And that was a very important thing. Romans 3 says, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. Romans 3, verse 20. Very important purpose of the law. It reveals sin. So it shuts the world up as guilty. It reveals sin in our life, and it becomes a tutor to lead us to Christ. That's the purpose of the law. Now, once we have come to Christ, Paul goes on to say in Romans or Galatians chapter 3, verse 25, after faith has come, we are no longer under a schoolmaster. We are no longer under the letter of the law, but rather what happens is a new nature has been given into us. Now, this becomes a good mirror. We can see what's here and what God considers holy, and it reveals to us our heart. But by trying to keep the law, we have no strength. Appealing to God for his power to live as Jesus said, upon loving God with all your heart and loving your neighbor as yourself, upon these two laws, everything else hangs. So this particular law, these Ten Commandments, which sum up the 613 laws of Israel, these are given for those purposes. Now all the people witnessed the thunderings, the lightning flashes, the sound of the trumpet, the mountain smoking, and when the people saw it, they trembled and stood afar off. And they said to Moses, "You speak with us and we'll hear, but let not God speak with us, lest we die." And Moses said to the people, "Do not fear, for God has come to test you, and that his fear may be before you, so that you may not sin." So all the people stood afar off, but Moses drew near the thick darkness where God was. Now I can just picture the guys by their tents, "Go, Moses, go, go in there, Thank God he's going in there, because I wouldn't want to get near that thing." Well, the Lord said to Moses, "Thus you shall say to the children of Israel, you have seen all that I have talked with you from heaven. You shall not make anything to be with me, gods of silver or gods of gold you shall not make for yourselves. An altar of earth you shall make for me, and you shall sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and your peace offerings, your sheep and your oxen. In every place where I record my name, I will come to you, and I will bless you. And if you make me an altar of stone, you shall not build it of hewn stone, for if you use your tool on it, you have profaned it. Nor shall you go up by steps to my altar, that your nakedness may not be exposed on it." So there were certain requirements in regard to this altar that he made so as to minimize distractions, number one, and bringing attention to people. If the stones were all ornately decorated, people would be paying more attention to the stones than upon the need for the sacrifice. Even in a fellowship, we want to do everything we can to minimize distractions so that we can just hear the Word of God, let it become a part of us. And the aspect of this is important. Not have anything that's so ornate that that brings attention to it, but have a simple structure. If we get a facility, it'll be a simple facility. There's not going to be anything, I would say ostentatious about it, because the attention really needs to be upon the true church, which is the people of God. And the building needs to house the church. And anything that you use in worshiping the Lord, the idea here is he doesn't want any attention to be taken away from him. And that's the idea here.